It's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a good morning to you. It is 3.5 minutes past nine on this Wednesday, the 1st of May 2024, and we're broadcasting live across and from the sunny northwest of Ireland. And it's good to have you on board on the show today. And we have another busy one for you, as you know yourself. Our lines are open for you right now. So if you want to comment on any of the issues we've got lined up for you, or you want to raise your own or pass on some stories, or and as I say, we are love the positive stuff as well, please get in touch with us. The WhatsApp line is 086 60 25000, and more of you each day are sending your voice notes into that number. Please feel free to do so. It's a great way to be in contact with us. Or you can text the same number, an SMS, you know yourself. If you want to give us a call, it's 07491 25000, and your emails come into us at comments@highlandradio.com. And keep the conversation going on our social media as you watch the programme on your smart TV or Fire Stick, on the YouTube app, on Highland Radio Ireland. That's good on your mobile stuff as well. And we're on Facebook, Highland Hub, Highland News and Sport, and growing our audience every day on the X platform, Highland Radio Donegal. Right, let's look at some of the stories in the written press today. The Finn Valley Voice: when Maeve's hot chocolate saved a man's life. To Maeve O'Brien, originally from Ballybuffet, the shambling figure with the sleeping bag was just another homeless man. So she stopped her car and offered him a lift. Maeve did not know that 30-year-old Cian Murta was heading into the Galtee Mountains to take his own life. After years of sleeping rough, he'd lost all hope. He intended to stay in the Galtee Mountains, refusing food and drink until he passed away. It's a pretty big story, a moving story. I don't want to give it short shrift. So if you want to read it in full, get the Finn Valley Voice. On to the Irish Independent now. And Taoiseach Simon Harris has pledged to ban asylum seekers from creating shantytowns in Dublin City as they wait for their international protection applications to be heard. An operation to clear the makeshift camp housing around 200 asylum seekers outside the International Protection Office on Lower Mount Street got underway early today. Government sources said Gardaí will be asked to ensure tent camps do not return to the city. The Taoiseach held meetings with his ministerial colleagues, senior Guardian officials from Dublin City Council in recent days over plans to clear the encampment on Mount Street. And as I say, that started in earnest this morning. Quite interesting. I did listen to a number of people in the know, people in government who were interviewed on that, and none of them were able to say where they were going. So I presume Simon Harris isn't the only person that knows, but they're not making it public as to where these people are being moved to. The Irish Independent has learned plans are now in place to remove the tents early this morning and move the asylum seekers to alternative accommodation. As part of the operation, local Garda management have also directed additional measures to the area to oversee the move and ensure that it passes off without incident. This will involve uniformed Gardaí from the Dublin South Central Division, while a public order unit is also expected to be there. And as I say, all of those things have actually come to pass. Well, on to the Irish Times now. And Ireland will start returning asylum applications, or applicants, sorry, who came here through Britain within weeks under plans agreed by the government, although uncertainty remains over how effective the initiative will be in practice. Now, the bottom line is Britain's not taking these people back, and they've made that really quite clear. And the ace in the pack that they have is that, well, we'll start taking them back when France starts taking them back. Now, to claim that Ireland unilaterally has agreed a plan for migration deportments or migrant deportations to the UK within weeks without the UK having agreed that as well is kind of ridiculous. But anyway, it's presented this morning as fact. The Cabinet has agreed to change existing laws in order to allow the UK to be deemed a safe third country for returns, meaning asylum seekers who arrive across the border could be considered inadmissible applicants. But if they land at the centre in Dublin and claim asylum, they've claimed asylum, haven't they? What will the Irish government do with them? Now, apparently there was already agreements that were in place. And you might have heard the statements from, I think, Ms. McEntee stating that, well, they have sent no one back to England under the previous arrangements. And there was two reasons were given. One was COVID, right? So not a lot of things were happening during COVID, right? We can accept that. The other was a high court ruling meant that no one could be sent back. But the devil is always in the detail, isn't it? That High Court ruling was last month. Sorry, not last month now. It was in March. So between COVID and March, when that High Court ruling wasn't in effect, no one was returned to Britain. And I think that's important. Facts matter, don't they? So we'll see how successful this new plan is. But let's not forget the reason there was a system in place before. Obviously, there was that High Court ruling. But that High Court ruling can't be blamed for no returns to Britain because it didn't come into effect really until March of this year. While British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, reading on here, said he would not accept the return of asylum seekers from the Republic, Taoiseach Simon Harris said there was legitimate expectations that an existing November 2020 agreement on the return of asylum seekers between the two countries would be upheld. The British government has disputed that it has any legal obligation to accept asylum seekers from Ireland, a spokesperson for Number 10 Downing Street said. They were operational arrangements between the UK and Ireland, but not a legal obligation to accept the return of asylum seekers. And under those operational arrangements, no asylum seekers have been returned to the UK, as I've just outlined. Also, we heard from the Irish Refugees Council yesterday is that, you know, there's a lot of caveats there. It has to be deemed to be safe. As we said, they have to accept them. As we've said, it can be appealed. So anyone who is deemed to be returned to Britain can also appeal. So always read between the headlines and a little further down the articles, because everything is not always quite as it's presented. It would be great to see a little bit more critical analysis in the national newspapers, I think. A horrendous story that emerged yesterday. And it's not a story. It's an awful loss of life. And it's covered in the Irish Daily Mail and other newspapers. And the bottom line now is that often with these stories, we get pictures to accompany them because everyone has a mobile phone, the CCTV everywhere. And this is the story of a boy of just 14 years of age who was killed on his way to school yesterday when he was attacked by a sword-wielding knife man. Four other people, including two police officers, were injured in the apparently random attack in London. The 36-year-old suspect had rammed a van into a house near a tube station in Hanault in the northeast of the city before slashing members of the public and police officers who responded to terrified 999 calls. Chilling CCTV footage captured the knife man prowling the streets of the suburb before setting upon innocent passers-by during a 22-minute ordeal. And he has a sword that probably looks like it's 2 foot, and there's images of him wielding it. And then, of course, eventually being apprehended. But in the meantime, people severely injured, and a 14-year-old young fella on his way to school killed. The teen victim, who neighbours said was the youngest of three from a respected family, was rushed to hospital where he was later declared dead. Door camera footage showed the moment the suspect was finally arrested on a driveway of a semi-detached house after being tasered by a police officer. Absolutely horrendous stuff. All right, back home now and to the Irish Daily Star. Enoch Burke, still in prison. And he's suing a newspaper now who claims that he's not really or wasn't really very popular in prison. And I remember seeing these stories. Jailed teacher Enoch Burke insists he's so popular amongst inmates at Mountjoy Prison that he's been gifted free biscuits, haircuts and tennis shoes. Burke told the High Court that an utterly false newspaper article published about him in October 2022 was an attempt at character assassination. He said he was held up to ridicule as someone who should be shunned by society because of the story published by the Sunday Independent. Burke was brought to court from Mountjoy Prison yesterday to open his defamation action against the publishers of the Irish Independent and Sunday Independent. He's also suing editor Alan English and reporter Ali Bracken. The newspaper ran a story on Burke on October 9th, 2022, during his first period in jail and for contempt over his refusal to comply with the court order. I remember reading the article, it kind of had suggested that he was annoying prisoners and he had to be moved around and that type of stuff. He's contesting that never happened. And the bottom line now is the newspaper, and this is why you have to be careful with what you say. You can say anything on social media. But I presume their responsibility now is, and how they'll manage to do it, is they have to prove that he did annoy prisoners, that he was moved around because he was annoying prisoners, and that's going to be difficult for the newspaper. So that's an interesting story to follow. The vast majority of victims in cases of sexual assault were known to the suspected offender. This is the Irish Daily Mirror. And I was going to read this anyway, but I do recall during our Friday panel on Friday, it was suggested that, you know, the greatest threat to women in this country is, you know, their partners or people that they know. And people took quite a bit of offence at that, saying that, you know, that's not necessarily the case, or that's not true, or that's not fair. But these statistics would seem to back that up to an extent. The Central Statistics Office released its figures based on crime data collected by Gardaí. It shows that 7 in 10 victims of sex offences know their attacker, while 2 out of 3 victims of assault, threats to murder and harassment also knew the offender. The results also showed that nearly 2/3 of sexual offences reported by victims in 2023 were within a year of occurrence, but 1 out of every 5 offences reported referred to instances that occurred more than 10 years earlier. And finally, in the Sun this morning, the Taoiseach has agreed a debate on surgery waiting lists for sick children. Simon Harris said he was happy to discuss the issue after the paper told of a 14-year-old's 4-year scoliosis op delay. The Irish Sun Kids Can't Wait campaign is calling for action to fix the waiting lists hell faced by youngsters. Yesterday, Paddy Murphy and his mum, Megan, told the newspaper of his nightmare scoliosis surgery hold up. The curve in his spine has worsened to 100 degrees since being told back in 2020 that he needs an op, with Paddy declaring it's not fair. And I think we all remember the exclamations in the Dáil saying that, you know, waiting lists will be cut to this, that and then, and all resources necessary will be given to ensure these children get their operations as soon as possible. That hasn't quite transpired as was promised. But still, we'll keep an eye on that story as well. For many of us, if not most of us, the cost of heating our homes goes up today. Householders will have to pay more for their home heating oil, coal and gas supplies. It's the annual carbon tax hike taking effect. Effectively, €17 will be added to the annual cost of the average bill for 600,000 households that use natural gas. Not as big an issue in the Northwest as it might be elsewhere. €19, it's going to cost an extra €19 to fill a 900-litre home heating oil tank. So €140 now of your the cost of your home heating oil is now a carbon tax. That's based on a €900 litre fill. Bag of coal goes up as well. It's £5.85 is the carbon tax on a bag of coal at the moment. Bale of briquettes, the carbon tax goes up to €1.25. That's an increase of around 75 cent a bag of coal and 17 cent to the cost of briquettes. We've used less home heating oil in recent years than ever. But that is being offset by an increase in the purchase of aviation fuel. So whilst we're being taxed and potentially seemingly using less oil, coal, briquettes and what have you, unfortunately that's being offset by an increase in aviation fuel, which is a pain. So we're paying to reduce, we're reducing, but overall as a country we're using more because more aviation fuel is being purchased. Anyway, I just thought I'd mention that in case you were not aware. And we're going to be talking about the costs in this country versus elsewhere, i.e. The six counties, with Joe now. Hi, Joe.
How you doing, Greg? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, yesterday we spoke to a gentleman. He was of the view that 98% of people would vote for United Ireland. In the south, anyway, if that vote was to happen today, and of course, too, it also is very much dependent on how people in Northern Ireland might vote. You've been looking at some figures which suggest it might not be a fait accompli.
No, I don't think so, Greg. To be honest with you, I mean, we'll use the home heating oil as an example. 500 litres of home heating oil in Northern Ireland is £333. And 500 litres of home heating oil in the Southern Ireland is €530. Now, that equates to £454 difference. That's £454, which is a difference of £120. And that's a lot of money.
And that gap's only widening with the carbon tax and what have you. I think there's been a stay on...
The tax is now come in today. Mm-hmm. And that's going to increase that difference even more. Because that was in yesterday's figures. Mm. You know, it's like everything in down in Southern Ireland is going up in price. The electricity, the gas, like you said. I mean, it's when the companies turn around and put on these prices and increase them, they're quick to increase. But the market has stabilised for everything, electricity. But the prices aren't going down. Mm-hmm. They should be going down, and they're not. And I mean, I'll give you just one example. Is if my daughter suffers from a she's lactose intolerant, and she has to go for a free from range. Now, for her to go down and get a jar of free from sauce and Letterkenny, it's €4.60. Okay, and if we cross the border, which that equates to £3.60 mm-hmm. sterling. Now, if we cross the border and go and buy the exact same sauce out of a supermarket on the border, this is factual now, it's £1.20.
Wow.
So, it's, you know, £3.60 to £1.20.
£2.40 I mean, on one product. It's,
£2.40 on yep. one jar of sauce. Mm-hmm. That's the difference. And when you start looking across the range, it's absolutely mind-boggling how people can afford to turn around and actually supply their children with the free from range.
You've also been looking at
the leg.
You've also been looking at the health service differences, Joe, in your view.
Yeah, in the north, if I have a doctor, to go to see a doctor, I mean, it's free. I mean, I make an appointment, I go to see my doctor, it's free. And the size, you make an appointment, but it's €60, or it was €50 or €60. I'm not sure what it
depends.
Is.
Depends. It varies. It varies from practice to practice. So, like, and have yeah. you had to book a doctor's appointment recently? Do you have to wait long for an appointment, or?
No. We usually give, if you booked an appointment up in the north, you can be seen within about normally it's a week.
Right.
At the latest, it'll be 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But they will do an on-call with you immediately in the afternoon. They will phone you and say what seems to be the problem. The doctor will speak to you over the phone if he can't. And then if he thinks you need a prescription or whatever, he will send it out and tell you to go and collect it.
Petrol and diesel as well, obviously. The prices have gone up extensively south of the border, not so much in the north of the border either.
No. I think it's we're now coming on a par. It used to be we would help people travelling from the north across the south over the border at Bridgend or whatever to turn around and get their fuel. But it's actually now on a par with the north. I mean, the north's now on a par with the south with regards to the price of the diesel and the price of the petrol. So
how do you, that's sort of what you've been talking about so far, right? How do you think that then ties into the conversation about the prospect of a united Ireland, in your view?
Well, in my view, I mean, if you put the figures out there and people realise that what they're going to, you know, what's involved, I mean, the National Health Service alone, you know, in Northern Ireland is vast. It's mm-hmm. a vast network. And, you know, what happens to them people? What happens to their jobs? How do they get paid? If there was a United Ireland, how did that happen? You know, that's just one example. I mean, it goes forward. I mean, it's only this year that we're giving out free books in Southern Ireland for the school children,
yeah.
where free books have been handed in the north the last 50 years. You know, there's so many examples of where Ireland is now one of the most prosperous countries. Like when you think when the crash came and there were so many billion in debt, and now they've got 8.5 billion sitting waiting on a rainy day. What rainy day are they waiting on? You know, why are they not using that money and improving the health service, improving, get the electricity companies here making millions and, you know, start bringing them all on the line and start trying to help the ordinary man from Ireland. Mm. The people they're supposed to be looking after is the people that aren't being looked after. You know, the most vulnerable in society are being left by the roadside. That's not fair.
Right. That's your view. I appreciate you coming on with us and talking about it. Thanks so much for that, Joe. So that's Joe's take on it. What do you think? 086 60 25,000. If you're contacting us, I beg your pardon, from the north of Ireland, of course, 00 353 86 60 25,000 is how you would text us. Okay. People don't class Go Safe vans, says a listener, as a deterrent for speeding, but as a moneymaker for the company who owns the vans. As far as we see, vans are parked inside the 30-kilometre limit. Very rarely do you see them in black spots or in long stretches of roads. I was travelling to Galway a few weeks ago and there was a van parked behind a large sign around the knock turnoff. I, only from my driving experience, and I suppose that's all we can do, isn't it? We can sort of talk about our own experiences. I think the majority that I see are in the faster areas. But as I say, that just only accounts for the routes that I go on, doesn't it? It doesn't really account for what my listeners' experience is. Listen to an ad on the radio there talking about recreational drugs, not to drive. What's happening here? Seems to make it okay to take drugs, but not when driving. Does no one see the wrong in the ad in that it is telling people taking drugs is wrong, period? A zero tolerance should be taken. Right, let's have a listen to it. I haven't heard this ad, or if I have, I haven't taken note of it.
Recreational drugs can give you a different buzz, but they can all impair your driving. Some drugs can slow down your reactions, leaving you prone to error.
Other drugs can make you more aggressive.
More aggressive.
More aggressive.
And overconfident behind the wheel. So you make rash judgments.
Drive too fast and take dangerous risks.
Drug driving can endanger you, your passengers and other road users. Never ever drive under the influence of drugs. A message from the Road Safety Authority. Visit rsa.ie.
Right, okay, I see where the listener is coming from there in that it should say don't take drugs. I don't know. Would that confuse the message a little bit? I mean, it's don't drive when you've taken drugs. I think, you know, the bottom line is people do take drugs. It kind of reminds me of at major festivals and what have you, where they have tents specifically to deal with people who have taken drugs. Should they be there, or should they be saying at the signs, don't come in here, or at the signs at the front saying, don't come in here if you've taken drugs? But I think really maybe that ad is saying, look, we know people do. They're not going to listen to that message, but don't get behind the wheel. I don't know. I haven't processed it yet. I'll open it up to you out there, of course. 086 60 25,000. What do you think? Is that it's not pro-drugs, but do you think it should be saying don't take drugs, full stop? Morning, Greg. I agree with a call you had on the show yesterday about Gardaí. I've saw them on a Sunday morning stopping cars while I'm going to early mass. I also hear them racing in the early hours of the morning. Thank you. Will you see the checkpoints in the morning are for the don't drink and then drive the next morning, aren't they? This is a listener yesterday who said that an awful lot of the Garda enforcement, this was this person's view, is, you know, between working hours, and a lot of people they apprehend are going to mass, going to school, going on a run, you know, for speeding or what have you. And then they're not as visible at night time when the caller claimed the boy racers and the girl racers are out doing donuts and causing havoc. And a lot of people actually agreed with him. Very few disagreed, it has to be said. That man on there that you had talking is absolutely right. I agree 100% with Dermot. We were talking about speeding on the roads too, fast and slow drivers. Another says some people can't bear to be behind another car. I saw a car on the Kilmaggrennan Letterkenny Road pass out three cars and a large digger. It was a miracle no one was killed. Another driving to Carrigart on Sunday, a black Ford Focus right up behind me, then decided to overtake two cars on a continuous white line and a car coming. He just got in on time. Another caller says, when a quad driver is in the country areas going to cop on and wear helmets. Met one on a road a day or two ago and it was driving at a high speed. No helmet, no thought for their fellow drivers. Very scary. Should it not be made law? Well, it is law. I think that law has actually come into effect now. It has. They have to be obviously licensed and insured to drive in the roads. They must wear a helmet. I do know for a fact there is some Garda enforcement of people on quads on the roads, but people will always take a chance, won't they? Well, I heard the government was going to spend some time before the election to get the info out to all the refugees and DP, direct provision, on how to vote. Well, I guess we just heard it now. How can anyone who is temporary residence or asylum be entitled to vote in our local elections? That's against our right to govern ourselves. Shocking. It might be against the rights that you believe we have. It's unfortunately the rights as are set out for the local elections, and it's not the case. I have to agree with one of your callers. The biggest danger is in the house and in families. That being said, when going out with friends, I think we have to be proactive in terms of getting home safely, know your friends, etc. Darren on Facebook says, good morning, Greg. If you're going to quote your panel guest, quote her properly. Sorry, Darren. She said the biggest threat to the assault to women in Ireland is basically Irish men, not immigrants. Well, you see, that's not strictly the case because the statistics would tell us otherwise. And then he goes on to quote a figure, 7 out of 10 assaults on women in Ireland are committed by immigrants. That's just really not the case, Darren. And I hope you would know, listening to the show, we try and be fact-based. 7 out of 10 assaults on women are from people that they know. 7 out of 10 assaults on women in Ireland are committed by immigrants. That would be unbelievable because the figures, it would, because the amount of immigrants that are in this country, it can't be factually correct because they're simply... would be so overrepresented, it would be crazy. But I appreciate your input as always. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but these statistics are consistent and go back a very long time, far longer than 3 or 4 years. But anyway, I'm not going to argue the task. We need to get to the bottom of it, whoever is responsible, and eliminate it from our society. We're told the biggest issue in the country in people's minds, and that is the housing crisis. And I suppose we were talking about how it affects different groups in different ways. Some are more obvious than others. But those in a wheelchair, for an example, or those represented by the Irish Wheelchair Association, often find themselves in unsuitable housing that's dangerous and damaging to their health. And to a great extent, these are, you know, victims of the housing crisis that we don't really hear from. It's a silent housing crisis, as it's been described. Jean Coleman is National Housing Programme Manager with the Irish Wheelchair Association and will be able to outline this much better than I tried to. Jean, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg. Thanks for having me on.
Right. Talk to us then about the experience and the reality of those you speak on behalf of.
Yeah, we support people, particularly wheelchair users who are looking for housing all around the country. And while there's lots of talk about the national housing crisis, it's very much a crisis within a crisis for wheelchair users. And this has been going on for years. And there are particularly people who are living at home with elderly parents. Lots of people are living in unsuitable, inaccessible accommodation. As you know, people's needs change. Not everybody is born with a disability. I think the last census showed about 22% of the population actually say they have a disability now. So there are lots of people in accommodation that is totally unsuitable to their needs. There are other people then who are in homes and they can't access all of their homes. And we all know that you like to access every part of your home. I speak to a father recently, a wheelchair user, and he can't go in to say goodnight to his children in their bedrooms. He can't, you know, so it's access to all parts of the home. So last year within the Irish Wheelchair Association, we had a campaign called Home Truths, because everybody deserves a place to call home. And in that, we highlighted the barriers that wheelchair users face in looking for suitable accommodation. So, for example, there was one gentleman who is on HAP, which is totally unsuitable. That's the housing assistance payment. Totally unsuitable and doesn't really meet the needs of wheelchair users, because there basically isn't wheelchair accessible accommodation out there. I looked up Daft and Donegal there yesterday, and I think I saw two properties that were rent under wheelchair accessible, but actually they were both two-storey houses.
Yeah, so you could say there's a ramp to the front door. The front door is somewhat wide. Wide enough to accommodate a wheelchair, and there might be a downstairs bathroom that can accommodate someone who uses a wheelchair, but it doesn't talk of how high the kitchen table is, how high the counters are, access to all parts of the house. So whilst it might on paper appear to be, it's accessible, but usable maybe is a sort of a different sort of criteria.
Yeah, I think the term, Greg, is the building regulations now are that houses have to be wheelchair visitable. So that basically means you have to get in a door and access a downstairs bathroom and a room. But it's not wheelchair livable. So if you think about all the houses that are being built, most of them will have a toilet maybe under the stairs. That's no good to a wheelchair user who can't get in or can't close the door, mm-hmm. but they're ticking the box. So until the building regulations in the country actually change, and we have another campaign trying to change the building regulations, because until they change, nobody is going to build future livable housing.
Yeah, of course. And that's what we're talking about, really, is future housing stock. We can do sort of piecemeal retrofitting, or people can do that individually, but really we have to be talking to the future. But if someone with a disability, or particularly a wheelchair user, for them to feel that they're actually recognised, understood and accommodated by society, already every public building or every building that's being built, shopping centres, whatever, should all be fully wheelchair accessible, should they not? And I don't know what the percentage of new housing, particularly public housing, I presume, should be fully wheelchair accessible. But is there any... In terms of, so say, for instance, if I wish to build 100 houses now, am I obliged to have any of them to be fully wheelchair accessible?
No, none of them. Not fully wheelchair accessible. And that's where the issue is with the building regulations. So you will probably, if you were, and you know, all the numbers that we see and the delivery is great in terms of housing, but they're not wheelchair livable. So they're ticking the box, they're building according to the regulations. So it's like that example of probably a toilet under a stairs. Yes, you would be able to get in a door in the house, but you would not be able to access. So it's like on Daft, wheelchair accessible. You know, you're looking at two-storey houses. That's not wheelchair livable.
Is the problem here, though, obviously, you know, the construction building industry, very powerful and will great influence on government. Let's make no bones about that. Any government, by the way, not just this government, any government. And really, without them, we can't deliver any housing. So it's difficult really to put them in a corner and say you must, because they might say, well, that means that this project is not viable for us, or this house could sit. Or, you know what I mean? There's a million excuses they might come back with. And that's, I think, Jean's going to be an issue going forward for us.
It is an issue. And I said to keep harping on, but unless the building regulations change, that won't change. And for example, the Irish Wheelchair Association would be on 29 of the 30 housing and disability steering groups around the country. So my colleague Owen is on, who's based there in Letterkenny, is on the Donegal Housing and Disability Steering Group. So even in terms of social housing, people are still not building for the building regulations. They're not building wheelchair livable.
Yeah, and it's, I think it's great you're speaking out, Jean, because I would say in the wider conversation, you know, wheelchair users, people with other disabilities, will feel unheard, not part of the conversation.
That's for sure. And I suppose we particularly like people to know about their rights. And I suppose that's where the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disability comes in. And that everybody has, under Article 19, people have a right to live independently and they have a right to supports. So that's a really important message. And that's the message that I'd like to get across to everybody with a disability, that they have a right to apply for housing. And also to supports, and that those supports can include wraparound supports. So I'd like to encourage people to, you know, if you're thinking about having your own home, you can apply for social housing with Donegal County Council. And you need to get your name on the list. So there is usually a couple of years waiting time. So it's very important that people don't wait until there's a crisis in their own family, when maybe a carer passes away and somebody is left basically maybe losing their home, losing their carers. So just the people have a right to apply for housing, and that's there under the United Nations Convention. Unfortunately, I think a report came out in January this year, and we see that Ireland actually regressed on Article 19, which is the one to do with living independently in the community. But that's not to say that people should still apply for housing.
Yes, of course. And it would seem that all roads are leading to the point whereby we're going to see less home ownership. So really, we really need to ensure, don't we, that our housing stock is for everyone, because there's a lot of people who are going to be renting as they go into retirement age or get older. That just seems to be, unless something drastic changes, that seems to be the way we're going. There's a lot of knocks on the doors at this time of year, Jean, of course. You know, a lot of people, and I think this could be a European issue, because, you know, MEPs can maybe hold a mirror up to Ireland on this issue in Brussels. So there are some issues they talk about that aren't really European, but this is one of those. And also, local authorities have a big role in this as well. So at least, you know, current members or new members of any local authority should hear on the doorsteps about this, so they can take that knowledge into the chambers with them.
100%. That we need to point out that there is a need for accessible housing. And certainly when politicians are calling, we need to be asking, you know, what's happening in relation to accessible housing. And I think to bear in mind, sometimes people think, you know, people with disabilities are other people. I come across people in my daily work who have had car accidents, who become disabled. who acquire disabilities like multiple sclerosis. So I think we need to be a little bit more inclusive and think about everybody, and that everybody has a right to housing.
Yeah, and that at any stage, and you know, people will say, God forbid, but at any stage it could be any of us in that position that all of a sudden have this clear understanding of exactly what the point you were trying to make there. A caller says there's a fabulous new house in Port New available for rent with disability accessible hoists, showers, suitable beds, and it's near the beach with a beach wheelchair and disability friendly beach gym. But it's a holiday home destination. But still, at that, you know, at the end of the day, isn't that
people
nice?
People with disabilities still want to
go on holidays. That's what I was going to say.
We all want to live the same lives as everybody else. So that's great to hear.
Yeah, indeed. And they've done brilliant work, local campaigners, wheelchair users themselves, in getting those toilets and that accessibility there. But hey, exactly, rental properties are needed for people with disabilities too. Families deserve to be able to go away together. Jean, okay, listen, thank you. As I say, just it's another thing to talk to your prospective councillors, MEPs about. Thanks for your time, Jean.
Thanks, Greg.
Bye-bye. Jean Coleman there, National Housing Programme Manager with the Irish Wheelchair Association. A caller says the refuse bins are collected free of charge in Northern Ireland. That comes in from Mary. Indeed, access to swimming pools and all is free as well. They do have rates. We have this system here whereby we pay a property tax and we're told the value we get for the property tax is that it's used for match funding, for an example. If they want to put toilets at the base of Errigal or whatever it might be, it's not actually really used directly to provide any services. Greg, I live in the north, and if I go to the doctor, you get an appointment the next day. And to be honest with you, I live in the south, and I could get an appointment the next day as well. It just, a lot of the time, depends on where you are. So, but I'm not in any way diminishing your point of view there, but I am conscious that the experience for people in Donegal, in terms of access to their GP, is it depends on where you are. And the access to the dentist as well depends on where you are. Hi, Greg. I wonder what would happen if everyone that has a car, van, bus, lorry or tractor did not take their vehicle out for a week in rural Ireland. There wouldn't be much happening every day. We get slated when we tax, insure, NCT or test our vehicles. Sick listening to it every day when there are five times more people taking their own lives. Yes, indeed, there are. And work is ongoing to get a proper sense of those figures. I do understand where people come from when they talk about, we're talking about road fatalities, and then they sort of say, yes, but you talk about road fatalities and we're hearing ads, and what are we doing about mental health? We would talk about sort of mental health supports way more on this program than we would dangers on the roads. And there's an awful lot of services, or be them perhaps under-resourced or underfunded, to deal with people with mental health issues compared to the road. So I think sometimes that seems like a very obvious point to make, but if you step back and say, we as a society, what infrastructure, supports, advice, conversation do you have on mental health versus the road side of things as well? They are the same, and often have an equally devastating impact in terms of loss of life, in terms of numbers of people as well. But I don't think you can actually compare them as people often do. But I'm open to that debate, by the way. That's just my gut feeling. If anyone wants to counteract that or agree or whatever, please 086 60 25000, or give us a call on 074 91 25000. But just back to that caller about living in rural Ireland and roads and what have you, and a thing that annoys the living daylights out of me, one of the things that you would say, is the fact that, you know, if you've got an older vehicle, and many of us have older vehicles, or if you're a new driver and you don't know if you're going to have the vehicle for a certain amount of time, you might want to tax your car for 3 or 6 months compared to the year. And also, maybe you can't afford to tax it for the year. It can be anything from €200 up to, my word, €1,600 for an older 4x4 or something. And yet, it's not a private company. This is a charge that we pay the government. You are penalised for paying a smaller amount. So a car that's €200, someone just out on the road for the first time, €200, if they say, right, I'm going to go 6 months on this car, cost them €110. So there's a 10% surcharge being charged by the government to tax your car for 6 months compared to a year. How is that fair? It's not like in the old days where there was people, you know, writing stuff out by hand and all that. This is all digitalised. Is it not fair that people who can't afford to or choose not to tax their car for the full year have to pay say, for instance, with one of the lowest bands, €200 a year, have to pay a 10% surcharge to get that tax for over 6 months. I think that's crazy. I can't believe it's still the way it is, but it is. Jeremy O'Hanlon, film student at Clastia Dulig, CFE, Dublin. I think it might be Dooley, pronounced up this part of the world. But anyway, we'll not argue the toss on that. Jeremy, good morning to you.
Hi, how are you?
A full debate on that. I could get a panel in. But anyway, come here. You're working on a mixed media graduate project titled IU. And it's exploring themes of suppressed love. Talk to me a little bit more about this.
That's right, yeah. So it's an odd one. We've created this website, i-u.ie, and it's a platform where people can go on and write letters of love that for one reason or another they've kept in, they've suppressed, and they can't share for one reason or another. So we've created this platform where they can write these letters and send them to us. And we're going to take them and kind of collectively turn them into some kind of beautiful things artistically. We're going to make some, the first step of it is a kind of mixed media documentary, but we'd be hoping to develop the project further and kind of open it out to more artists and look to kind of build it into a full exhibition scale project. So we've just launched a website and we're looking to kind of share it out there and get people to engage with it if they're interested, or share it to groups and forums that they think might be interested in the project.
And are you looking for people maybe that retain a Valentine's Day card with a note on the inside, you know, not the poems but the note? Or are you asking people maybe, you know, they've got something in the back of their mind, they certainly couldn't talk about it with a current partner, what have you, and they want to just express that or get it out into the world? I mean, like,
exactly,
what kind
yeah.
of material are you looking for?
We're not overly prescriptive. It can kind of be anything, because like I know my own experience and my own ideas or that I might have that I might want to express, but that's kind of different for everyone. And we're really trying to reach people from all walks of life, and everyone's experience is going to be different, and everyone holds in feelings for different reasons. There's so many reasons we hold in feelings, and love is just thing that's so connective. We all kind of want it and need it, but for some reason there are lots of things that kind of restrict us from actually expressing that or sharing that. So like you mentioned, it might be that you're in a relationship or the other person is in a relationship. Could be to do with kind of societal issues that you can't express yourself. And even just kind of going beyond romantic relationships in your family, with your friends, sometimes the nature of the relationship stops you being able to kind of openly express those feelings. So we're just kind of looking for, it's not set out. We're kind of looking to kind of create a platform where people can interact with it how they feel they want
to. You know, and I kind of think the cathartic word slightly overused, but like there's lots of different love as well. And especially, you know, like in my experience on this program, say for instance, even the loss of a shared loved one in a relationship, be it, you know, an unborn child or a young child or what have you, we are very individual and we deal with things in different ways. And often you might have one partner who feels the loss very, very greatly, but they suppress that or perhaps even repress it because their partner does not feel the same way or has a different approach or a different attitude. So this is even an opportunity maybe for someone to get something like that out into the world, and they might see it as as something that's quite beautiful in marking a life that was or perhaps was not.
Absolutely, yeah. And I kind of feel like these things, it's a form of energy. Feeling is a form of energy, and of all the things, anonymity gives you the opportunity to express those feelings that for one reason or another you can't. But we have so many kind of connective platforms that we communicate through where there is anonymous expression, and it's kind of overrun by these kind of frustration or resentment or aggression. And the kind of quieter emotions that are actually positive and connective are kind of just hidden away, and there isn't really a space to express them. So that's what we're really trying to explore. Because I kind of feel like they're the much more common feelings, that the kind of negative ones suck up all the air and make all the noise. But really, most of us are kind of just carrying on day to day without those feelings. And we're kind of holding on to these positive ones or connective ones.
And there's an awful...
And
there's
just
a lot by of,
expressing them.
Yeah, so there's a lot of people actually really verbally struggle to demonstrate affectional love.
Yeah.
They feel
Absolutely.
It. They
yeah,
feel
yeah.
it and they show it, but they find it difficult to actually express it. And of course, then there's unrequited love as well.
Yeah.
Which can be often the most painful.
And writing can be a really, really nice way to kind of figure those thoughts and feelings out, because speaking, you can kind of get in your own way sometimes. But by writing, you're kind of taking time with yourself, and you can formulate your thoughts, and you can kind of understand them better once you put them down in words. It's externalizing them, so you kind of see it from another perspective, and it's positive for yourself as well as positive for whoever you're sharing it with.
Yeah, and I think maybe is it to some extent these types of interviews and getting the word out there are necessary, obviously, because you have to get the message out, but they're kind of counterintuitive, because I'm trying to give examples or get examples from you, but I get the sense that you want this project actually for people to interpret as they see fit, that it's, you know, completely organic and representative of all the different types of love people might feel.
Yeah, and we're going to kind of look at what we receive and try to find commonality or connections within them, and to kind of curate them into something collective that says something about us as a society or as a group of people. So I don't want to push people too much, but if I think about it, I can think of several examples of my own. Like, I had a brother who passed away about a year and a half ago, and the nature of our relationship, we had a really good relationship, but we never would have told each other we loved each other. It just wasn't in our language and our way of expressing. And it wasn't necessarily needed, but I kind of wonder, like, would he have felt something different if I had ever really told him that? And it, for me, it could be an opportunity to just express that feeling that I never really literally verbally expressed. But I think for a lot of people, it's going to be very different.
I strongly suspect he knew fine rightly how much you loved him.
Yeah.
But I do take your point.
As
you say, it's subjective and personal, but I've no doubt he did. So if people want to check out more about the project, submit what they wish to submit, www. Which, saying that nowadays is irrelevant. But anyway, it's i-u.ie.
Yeah. So it's a tricky one to say. It's I, just the letter I, dash, the character dash, and U, the letter U. So it's three letters along the website.
Who came up with that? Because some of these people that come up with these websites need a really good scene to a good chatting to. That sounds so threatening. They need a good chat to. I didn't intend to sort of threaten violence. Okay. lowercase I, or uppercase, it will get there anyway. I dash U, the two letters, .ie. No, it's actually not one of the worst ones, Germany. Okay, listen, I hope you get a good feedback. Look forward to see the finished project.
So
okay, take care of yourself, Germany. God bless.
Really appreciate
you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
No problem. Cheers. Jeremy O'Hanlon there, film student at Clastia Dooley, CFE Dublin. All right, i-u.ie. Terrible unbalanced attack on businesses and services in Donegal this morning. The man's totally wrong. Northern Ireland is propped by the UK taxpayer. €1,200 property tax and the worst health service in the UK and Ireland. That was just his experience and his lived experience. And my platform here is unless someone says something that's completely ridiculous, the platform here is for people to say what they feel. That's what he feels. And he talked about how he bought to purchase products for his daughter, that he felt it was cheaper for him to see his doctor. He felt he has better access to health services in the north. That's his lived experience. Hi Greg, just had building control assessment done on my house by an engineer. Defective concrete present. Looking for advice whether I should apply to go on the scheme now, or is it best to hold off? Is the scheme going to change? I think the general advice is to go on the scheme, because even those that went on the 90-10 scheme, and please, by the way, anyone who knows more about this, correct me if I'm wrong, even those who went on the 90-10 scheme then get moved to the next scheme. I think if the scheme's widened out to include foundations and what have you, hopefully then some people are holding off. It's a tough one, but the advice I seem to be getting from those in the know is that get onto it, start the process. Back after the news and obituary notices.